How do I know what I think until I see what I say?
The Green Notebook, carried by military leaders around the world. Within those pages are sweat, tears, triumphs, and the hard-won lessons of life. Lessons worth sharing. Each week, the team dives into the notebooks of military leaders, business professionals, authors, athletes and coaches, and entertainers to share lessons and help you lead with the best version of yourself.
Today's episode is sponsored by Adaton. I got to know Adaton's co-founders, James and JJ, several years ago. They are former Army NCOs who have years of experience in the tech industry. They have firsthand knowledge of what it's like to serve and truly listen to service members in order to understand the critical challenges they face today. Adaton understands that most military jobs are not performed behind a computer desk. They kept hearing leaders ask for a better way to support and care for their people, regardless of their location. This led to the development of Adaton's flagship software product, Muster, spelled M-U-S-T-R. Muster is like a digital knife hand. It streamlines the daily task of ensuring people accountability, resilience, and automation of data calls that currently rely on phone trees, text messages, and manual data entries into Excel spreadsheets. Muster revolutionizes the way leaders take care of their people, which is their primary responsibility, not sitting for hours in front of their computers. Many branches of the military are now utilizing Muster. The time is right for leaders to get involved and see the impact it can have. If you're interested in making an impact or learning about what other units are doing, reach out to Adaton. For a limited time only, listeners of the From the Green Notebook podcast can try out Muster for free. Visit adaton.io/FTGN to get started. That's adaton.io/FTGN. Welcome to another episode of From the Green Notebook. I'm your host, Joe Byerly, and this week we're diving into the notebook of Stephen Pressfield. Stephen Pressfield is the author of The Legend of Bagger Vance, The War of Art, and Gates of Fire, among other titles. And his recently published book, The Daily Pressfield, is the first thing I read each day when I wake up. This is Steve's third appearance on the podcast, and I keep inviting him back because I learn something every time I speak with him. In this episode, we discuss a lot of different topics. We talk about the power of words, how a quote or paragraph in a book can impact our day-to-day lives much more than reading an entire book, for example. We talk about why resistance needs to be acknowledged before embarking on any endeavor, whether it's weight loss, a military exercise, or writing a book, and how to focus when things are falling apart all around you. We also spend some time discussing the importance of answering our call, whatever that may be, because when we don't, bad things happen in our lives. Again, there's a lot going on in this episode, and I hope that you learned as much as I did from talking to Steve. So grab your green notebooks, and please welcome to the show, Stephen Pressfield.
Great to be here, Joe. Thanks for having me. It's really three times, huh? Wow.
It is. Yeah, it's like Saturday Night Live. It's third.
Yeah. I feel like Steve Martin. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to invite you onto the show to talk about your latest book, which has now inserted itself into my morning routine. The Daily Pressfield. It's become the first thing that I read right before I get started with my routine of writing or reflection or even just picking up a book.
Ah, great, Joe. I'm delighted to hear that. Terrific. That's what I was hoping it would happen.
It's working. And so the first question I have, and I've started thinking about this a lot as I read your book every single morning, is it doesn't take a lot. Like, it doesn't take an entire book to unlock something. Sometimes it's just a word, a phrase, a passage, or a quote that can really get things moving for you. I'm curious about that in your life as well.
Yeah, I think it's definitely true. I hate to praise Instagram, but you know, that's a lot of what that sort of stuff is. You know, it's like when people will come on with one simple thought, like Robert Greene is a big favorite of mine, and it'll be just something about, you know, get to work, you know, that kind of thing that you can absorb And sometimes it's like a thought for the day. It becomes like a thought for the day that kind of just establishes, you know, the way you're going to look at the day. And whereas if it's something that's much longer than that, like reading a book or a whole chapter of a book, you know, there's so much stuff in there that it all kind of fuzzes out. So that was kind of the theory behind, where do I have the daily press field? I got, here. You know, like a 365-day thing, like a devotional, you know, with a thought each day. Yeah. So I'm glad to hear that it's part of your routine, Joe. That's great.
And then you actually have evidence of it in the daily press field. But, you know, as you look back on your career as a writer, what were some of the, you know, the key passages or things that you came across that all of a sudden led to these, you know, amazing projects that you ended up working on?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you're thinking about like where ideas come from, like
right.
for a book or something like that. Yeah, it is interesting that they sort of come in small packages, too. Like one thing that I write about in the Daily Press Field is where my first book about Alexander the Great, The Virtues of War, that evolved from two sentences that just kind of popped into my head out of nowhere that I recognized as the first two sentences of a book. But I didn't know what book it was or who was saying the sentences. The first two sentences were, I have always been a soldier. I have known no other life. And I kind of sat with those for months, sort of asking myself, well, who's saying this, you know? And then finally, it just sort of said, this is Alexander the Great. And so that was the start of a book, just on a little nugget of something that came out of nowhere. Another thing, Gates of Fire, the inspiration for that was just like one paragraph in Herodotus's The Histories about the Spartan Deianikes at Thermopylae, that famous quote where he said, the good will have our battle in the shade, that famous quote.
Right, right.
And that set that whole book in motion for me. So it definitely has happened for me that just little snippets of something will be the impetus for something a lot bigger.
There's a couple for me that come to mind too. And I think about that, you know, that my fascination with the hero's journey began from a blog post that you wrote in 2012, May 16th, because I wrote it down.
Wow.
Yeah, there was like one line at the end, you know, you wrote that it's the software that we're all hatched with. And I don't know why, right? Like it kind of stuck with me over the years. And then one of the books, you know, a couple years ago you recommended to me was Father Richard Rohr, Falling Upward, that I read.
Yeah.
He had one and again, stayed with me. The end is already planted in us at the beginning and it gnaws away at us until we get there freely and consciously. And so I like those two together is kind of what sparked, I think it's beyond fascination right now, maybe an obsession with writing about the hero's journey.
Yeah. Tell me about that, Joe. Like what did that kick off in you and how have you been following through on it?
I think, you know, when you wrote about it in 2012, I've never heard of it before. You know, it was the coolest thing that I had ever read. And then as I, you know, continued to read, to watch movies, I kept seeing that format that you wrote about with Joseph Campbell in these stories, in these movies. And then, you know, when I got into the habit of reading, writing, and reflection, I started realizing I could see these things. I could see the mentors. I could see the allies. You know, I could see the trials and the call and all that.
You mean in your own life?
In my own life, yeah. And I was like, I have to write about this. And so, yeah, that's what I've been doing for the last 365 days plus.
Great.
Yeah. And even as, you know, we talked about before about, I think I asked you one time, I said, hey, like, do you ever get stuck when writing and then just paying attention, kind of like you paid attention and those key quotes or key passages jumped out at you and led to books. You know, those times where I was stuck in this, paying attention to the world around me, either it was something somebody said, something I saw in a movie, something I read in a book, you know, all of a sudden helped get me unstuck.
Actually, I was talking to a guy just 2 days ago, who's not in our field at all. He's like a wealth manager, you know, a guy that manages people's money, but is constantly coming up with ideas for stuff like that. And I asked him kind of, where do you get this stuff? And he says, He goes out of his way to put himself in social situations where he's going to meet people that are kind of out of his element. Like he'll go to conferences, you know, he'll go to seminars. He'll definitely insert himself, even like in golf. He'll go to like golf events, you know, and he says he's just always sort of has his antenna up and he's looking for just what we're looking for, you know, something that'll spark something that'll get you moving when you're in a kind of a stuck situation. So there's a lot to that.
And Jung called it synchronicity, you know, when your inner world and your outer world kind of align to help you out. And there's a great book by Dr. Lisa Miller called The Awakened Brain. She's She's devoted her life to studying this stuff, like actual doing brain scans and everything like that. And what she found is when you are on a quest, when you have what she calls the questing mind, different parts of your brain light up and different parts of your brain connect and your just life is completely different. It's almost like the actual visual representation of that antenna that you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
So anyways, it's completely fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's like if you start to think about, you know, I'd like to buy a 56 Chevy, right? You know, you'll start seeing them, right?
Right.
Where you would never see them before. Or I think if we're sort of working, if our unconscious is working on some idea, like for you, something about the hero's journey was percolating in your brain even before you'd heard anything from anybody, right? You were receptive to it. It's like your radio dial was on that frequency, but the signal hadn't come in yet. And then when it does come in, suddenly it lights everything up and there's a connection, you know, and then you jump off from there.
Yeah, yeah. It's been an amazing journey of self-discovery. And speaking of self-discovery, I'm curious, as I've been going through, I'm opening my daily press field right now. And so I'm on day 57. That's where I'm at. And
a good
and
day.
You've got stuff from 10, 13, 14, 15. You got emails in there. And so I'm wondering, as you were compiling this book, what did you learn about yourself that maybe wasn't there before you started the project?
It's a great question. Kind of the concept of the book is that each chapter is just one page and it's divided in two parts. And the first part is kind of a quote from something that I wrote in fiction or nonfiction or whatever. And then the second half of that is kind of a little commentary about that. So it did make me go back over, you know, usually I only cite stuff from like the War of Art and other things that are about the creative process. But in this one, I wanted to go back and do, you know, from stuff from fiction, from Gates of Fire and Virtues of War and da-da-da and all that sort of stuff. And also from blog posts. So, because there were so many of them. And it wasn't like I learned anything new, Joe, but it did sort of tie a lot of my stuff together in my mind where I thought, this is all on one subject, you know, it's not scattered like anybody might think it is. And it did sort of reinforce for me the obsessions that I have, like you with the hero's journey. You know, I thought, wow, these themes recur constantly. So that was good. It gave me more confidence that I actually had a point of view and it was something I was trying to communicate.
Well, let's go into the daily press field. And you actually begin with the negative. You begin with talking about resistance right off the bat. What was your thought process on just starting right there with resistance?
Well, I sort of was hoping that the book would be something that if a reader was working on a long form project like you are with the Hero's Journey book, or somebody writing a screenplay or starting a new business or whatever it was, that they could pick up the Daily Press Field at day one. The book would kind of walk them through the process the year long process that they were going to go through. And so the first chapter, day one of the Daily Press Field, is titled Resistance Wakes Up With Me. And it's about how people have asked me, when do you, in your day, do you first experience resistance, capital R resistance, you know, self-sabotage, the tendency to distraction, self-doubt, all that sort of shit. And my answer is the minute I open my eyes. And I thought, if somebody is reading this, they're starting on a book, you know, like you with the hero's journey, day one, you open your eyes And the first thing you're going to think is, maybe I shouldn't do this today. Maybe I should take a day off, you know, or this is a bad idea. I'm not good enough to do this. You know, in other words, resistance is going to be the first thing that hits them right away before they even sit down at the keyboard or whatever they're going to do, you know, if they're a dancer or a photographer, whatever. So I just wanted to start with that and sort of say to the reader, this is going to be your reality for the next 365 days if you're working on a long form project. So you might as well face it right now, that every morning you're going to wake up and there's going to be this devil staring in, you know, this dragon that you have to slay. And we might as well get, you know, set your mind to that right now, because that's the bottom line reality for the whole year or for the rest of your life. So that was why I wanted to start with that.
I think it was perfect. And a couple things. So the first thing is that, like I told you, it's the first thing I've started reading for the last, you know, 57, 58 days now. And there's been a couple times already where I didn't feel like, you know, putting the work in.
And then only a couple.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe a couple more than that.
Even David Goggins doesn't want to do it every day.
Yeah. But you know, I would read it and it's, you know, in your face, like, hey, you want to be an amateur or you want to be a pro? Put in the work. And so it's been a great kind of morning pep talk. The Daily Pressfield is the only person up with me at 4:30. The other thing is, you know, we're talking about writing, we're talking about the creative process. I recently had a bunch of my soldiers go through something that we call the Expert Infantry Badge or Expert Soldier Badge. And it's this this week-long testing process. It has a terrible pass rate. It's actually really low. And you do everything from basic soldier skills to, you know, land nav at night to walking a 12-mile foot march with weight on your back. You know, the first thing told them before they started the week, I said, hey, when you're doing land nav and you start doubting yourself, there's going to be a voice that tells you you're not going to be able to do it. You're not going to make it in time. You're going to hear the same voice on the ruck march. You'll be at mile 9 and you're going to want to start slowing down. It's even going to encourage you to slow down. I was like, that is resistance with a capital R. And several have come up to me since and actually told me that when they were struggling with the self-doubt and just wrestling with completing it and earning their badges, that, you know, that idea of resistance actually gave them strength that they can persevere and get on the other side of it.
Oh, that's great, Joe. I'd never heard that before. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's something I think, you know, you say it in the War of Art and it's in there too. Anytime you have a calling and want to make yourself better, however important it is to you, it's going to be met with an equal and an opposite,
yeah,
just as powerful force that you've called resistance.
But the other thing, you know, Joe, like, that was really smart of you to tell those soldiers on their week-long thing at the start. It's sort of like in a marathon, the idea of hitting the wall, right? That happens at mile 22, mile 23 every time, right? Because your muscle glycogen runs out at that point, right? And your body has to switch to burning fat for energy. But if you know that that's coming, then when it hits you, you don't panic. You know, when your legs turn to lead and stuff like that, you can just say, oh, okay, this is me hitting the wall, you know? So just hang in there for another 2 minutes and things will be okay. And it's so great to be forewarned about something like that. So you were very smart to tell them that. And it's so true. There are those predictable points where the shit's going to hit the fan and the bottom's going to drop out. And if you can just keep going.
Yeah.
You know, you get through it.
As I've continued doing this, you know, writing and doing the podcast, doing the blog, what I've come to learn, and this is one of the things I'd written you before the interview, is answering the call doesn't necessarily equate to sunshine, rainbows, and unicorns. There's actually a lot of suffering involved with it.
I think that's basically the gist of it. Yeah, there is no sunshine, really. Robert Greene has a great thing. I'm a big fan of him. Do you follow him at all, the 48 Laws of Power and that sort of stuff?
I do. And actually, before I even started the podcast, I did an interview with Robert.
Ah.
And it was like an hour and a half recorded phone call that I typed out you know, the questions and answers and everything, and turned it into like a week long blog post when his last book came out. I was completely enamored by the guy.
Yeah. One of the things he says, instead of other than sunshine and unicorns, is he really stresses, and I've never heard anybody else stress this, the tedium of a lot of the stuff that you have to do. Like, I was just thinking, if you want to be a concert pianist, you got to play scales for hours, right? Or if you want to be a black belt in karate or whatever, you have to do all the poses and all of the very, you know, over and over and over, you know? So it isn't only just the hell of, you know, say writing or something like that, or running long distances, the pain of the stuff, you know, the dramatic pain. A lot of it is about boredom, is about, can you hang in there? Do you love it enough to do that? Because you know what it is with writing, there's so many days where you're just grinding it out, you know, or any sport you want to think of, shooting free throws, you know. It's fun to do, but, you know, you got to do it for hours and hours and hours. And that's the difference. That's how you get good. And that's another sort of difference between, in my mind, between an amateur and a pro. That an amateur hits that tedium, that boredom, and they bail out. That is boring. This sucks. I don't want to do it, you know. But a pro sees it for what it is, that this is what really makes the difference, separates the men from the boys.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure your son Brady, you know, in all the athletic stuff that he's doing, he's got to do a lot of repetitions that he doesn't particularly want to do.
I think it's so important to convey that. And yeah, absolutely. The tedium. And I think, I know you've seen this, but just having a blog, having a podcast, people have reached out to me over the years wanting to start their own. I can't tell you how many I've seen do it for maybe a week or two, maybe at most a month, or get a couple episodes under their belt, and they just stop because it takes a lot of work. And I think that's the thing, is you got to love it and you got to be willing to suffer for it. Over the last 4 years, I've developed a morning ritual of reading, writing, and reflection. But before I do any of that, I brew a hot cup of my favorite coffee, Alpha Coffee. They make premium 100% Arabica coffee, and Alpha has some of my favorite blends. They have Dawn Patrol, which is a nice medium light breakfast blend. I also enjoy Charlie Don't Surf, which is a medium Kona blend. And when I go to the field for training, Alpha comes with me because they also make K-Cups and they make instant coffee too. You've got to try their Seven Summits instant coffee. Not only do they have great coffee, they're a great veteran-owned business who has shipped over 22,000 bags of coffee to deploy troops. They also offer a 10% discount to members of the military and first responders. You can find a link to their website in the show notes, so go check them out and make Alpha Coffee part of your morning ritual and taste the Alpha difference.
Let me ask you, Joe, from your own experience, I got to take my hat off to you. The amount of things that you have going, you know, you got a family, you got kids, you got a wife, you're a battalion commander, and then you're writing a book, you've got a podcast, you got From the Green Notebook, all the things you do there. How do you do it? What keeps you going?
Yeah, I think it's understanding my purpose. So, you know, for me, my purpose is helping others lead with the best version of themselves. So that's like this passion I have. And I read it somewhere, and this could be wrong, and if it is, we'll just edit this out. The Latin root for passion is passio, which means to suffer.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So the passion of the Christ is the suffering of the Christ. And so I think about that a lot. There's certain things that I'm willing to suffer for and to put in the work. And I don't know, maybe I'm just wired different, but I enjoy every single aspect of it. Like, I enjoy leading, even when it sucks. I enjoy writing, even when it sucks. Trying to be present for my family, you know, even when I want to zone out or, you know, go do something else, scroll on Instagram. I think it's about, what do you want to be passionate about? What means the most that you're willing to suffer for it?
So you were just saying, Joe, that like that your passion is to help others be the best version of themselves that they can be. Did you always feel like that when you were a little kid, or was there a moment when that came to you?
So in 2014, I did this exercise, and it was the highlights of your life. Like, where did you feel alive? And I wrote these things down on a piece of paper. And then the next question was, write five things that were your low points, like absolutely miserable. And it was childhood and professional. You know, I'm going back to, you know, wrestling when I was in high school, absolutely horrible at it. And I failed myself. Like I failed to lead myself. My coaches failed to like lead me, to lead me the way that I needed at that time in my life. You know, that's just an example. There's times professionally where I hated going to work every day, working for a leader who was just absolutely miserable to work for. And so anyways, as I was kind of piecing that thread together, I realized that the one thing that connected it all was leadership, whether it was me leading myself or somebody else leading me. And what I wanted to do is to help others lead for like the future me's, you know? So I don't know that maybe that's like too pie in the sky, Steve.
No, not at all. I mean, so I'm just curious about that moment, Joe, where did it come to you like while you were writing the answers to these questions?
It did. Yeah. And it was actually, it was a Simon Sinek exercise on,
on
finding your why. Yeah. But I think it was the writing it down and seeing them on paper. What about, I'll throw it back to you. You know, you've been doing this every single day now for decades. What's the thing that keeps you doing it?
That's a great question. I mean, it's really for me, there's nothing else I can do that doesn't leave me totally depressed or just full of anxiety and self-loathing, you know? And the only thing that sort of seems to work for me, you know, is to sit down in front of this and try to write a story or try to write something. And that's, you know, there was a moment, it's in the War of Art, where, you know, I was in this sublet apartment in New York City in 1972 or something like that. And the short version is that I was really kind of at the end of my rope. And I did sit down at the typewriter, this thing here, after running away from trying to write for years and years. And it worked, you know, just to do 2 hours of crap. I felt calm at the end of it. So it's not really a parallel to your story, but that was the key sort of turnaround moment for me when I sort of found something that worked for me.
Yeah.
You know, like David Goggins found that beating the crap out of himself, running 120 miles at 100 degrees Fahrenheit, that made him feel good when he was done.
Yeah.
So same to me.
I'm curious your thoughts. I have my own too. So you found the thing, right? Like that works for you. And I found the thing that works for me. What happens when you don't find that thing? Or maybe it's in the back of your brain calling you to do that thing, but you're ignoring it. You're pushing it down. You're running away from it. What do you think happens in your life when that happens?
An analogy that I use for this, my own mind, is that I think each of us has a kind of an underground river inside us flowing. And that's kind of our calling, or, you know, what Joseph Campbell would say, follow your bliss, whatever that is. The first half of our life, Richard Rohr would say, is about finding that underground river. But I think that if you don't do it, if you don't find that river, the river doesn't go away. It keeps flowing, but it flows into negative stuff. And out of that will come, I think, anxiety, alienation, you know, all of the bad shit that happens. People go into schools and start shooting people, you know, or it'll manifest as a disease or a vice like drug abuse or abuse of others, or it'll go into negative political things, you know, where people will fall into a category of hating some other group, you know, and go down a rabbit hole of that sort of stuff. I think that's that river that should be flowing into something positive, into your calling, whatever it is, and instead flows into these negative channels. So it's a bad thing. There are a lot of people who I would say are casualties of that dynamic. And again, like leadership, Joe, like you were saying, a lot of that is because nobody ever told them.
Right.
You know, nobody ever told me that we do need to look for our calling, for what makes us happy, for what works for us, and that there is something, you know, to believe in that there is something. It might seem like there isn't anything at all, but there is. So that's a kind of a failure of societal leadership.
I think that's why I'm like so obsessed with this hero's journey thing. There's a story, and I'll get to the quote in a second. This guy named Muhammad Al-Salman in 1945 found this jar near a farm in Nag Hammadi, Egypt. And in it, it was the 12 Gnostic Gospels of Jesus.
Ah.
And there's that one quote, it's attributed to him from the Gospel of Thomas, that's attributed to Jesus. And it says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is in you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you.
Wow.
And I've written this in one of my Sunday emails coming up. And yeah, I think that's so true. You know, I think in Government Cheese, you talk about kind of running away from it and then eventually accepting it and embracing it. I know in my own life, when I was trying to suppress it, not do the hard work of getting to know thyself and figuring out what that thing is for me, I was doing some bad stuff too, just destroying my life. And
yeah,
anyways, I think that's why I'm so passionate now about like writing about this.
Uh-huh. Tell me, what exactly are the Gnostic Gospels?
I don't know too much about them, Steve. All I know is that the Council of Nicaea basically said that this is canon. These are the books of the New Testament that we're going to use. These are the letters that we're going to use. But after Jesus's death, there were a lot of people writing. There's the Gospel, I think, of Mary Magdalene. There's the Gospel of Thomas and all these. And so, but only a couple made it into canon. So there's a lot of conspiracies. I think Dan Brown wrote about it in the Da Vinci Code and or Angels and Demons. But, you know, I tried to ignore the conspiracy part of it, of why the Gospels aren't accepted, but just kind of focus in on that quote that's a couple thousand years old. Whether or not Jesus said it, Young kind of gravitated towards it, Campbell kind of gravitated towards it, and I'm falling right in their footsteps.
All I know about the Gnostics is that my rabbi, Rabbi Finley, half Irish, half Jewish, was saying that the Gnostics believe, this is the only nugget I have, that the Gnostics believed that the human condition was exile. And I thought that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly have a feeling like I've washed up on an alien planet and I want to try and get back to what the real planet is, which I'm sure is spirit, you know, and not the material ego bullshit that we live day to day.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to show you this, Steve. This is it's actually attached to the hero's journey. So not only am I obsessed with the hero's journey, I'm also obsessed with the pictures of St. George. Are you familiar with...
I know is he slew the dragon, but explain it to me.
Yeah, he slayed a dragon. It's basically, it was modern day Libya is where, you know, the story supposedly takes place. But the thing about it is St. George is everywhere. Like if you travel around Europe, you'll see statues of him in squares. You'll see icons of them up on churches. And it's not just in like the UK or Germany, like even the country of Georgia is named after him. I think like, I can't tell you how many cities and countries in Europe he's the patron saint of, but I'll show you this real quick. Let me grab this.
Okay.
Yeah. Every depiction of George is the same. So you've got this knight on horseback slaying the dragon. And that's what everybody looks at. But this is the thing that I love about it. If you look at the dragon's tail, it's actually wrapped around the hoof of the horse that George is on.
I saw that somewhere too. Yeah. What is the meaning of that?
I don't know, but I've kind of interpreted it myself is that like everybody's kind of focused on, you know, maybe slaying other people's dragons or, you know, like trying to push down their shadow, push down the parts of them they don't like. And then what they don't realize is that the good and the evil are actually intertwined.
Mm.
together. And so, you know, kind of like what Campbell said, and you've written about in your writing Wednesdays of having to go down and dig through all the shit that you kind of push down from your ego, your persona, and pull out those things in there that are part of you, or at least acknowledging them, kind of bringing wholeness to that process of individuation.
Joe, what is it about the hero's journey that lights your fire so much?
I don't know, Steve. I think because, you know, you just see it so much, right? Like when you read the stories, the Epic of Gilgamesh, it's popped up in every single culture around the world. Like you said, I think it's in our operating system, and it provides almost like a instruction booklet for, you know, figuring out what that thing is that you found out in that sublet apartment, or, you know, that I found out doing an exercise and I need to do in the morning through reading and reflection, whatever that is. And Rabbi Finley talks about it too. We'll pull him into this conversation about how, you know, we're all
have him on the podcast. Have you ever had him on the podcast?
Yeah. I had him early on. And he talks about how, like, you know, our purpose is kind of to feed back into the community of everybody else. You know, we all have a gift that we were put on earth, a mission, whatever. And our mission is to figure out what that mission is and then to bring that gift back for everybody else. And so I think with the hero's journey, it's about discovering that. And that's why we keep telling the same story over and over and over again, because it's part of our collective unconscious, you know, as humans.
Yeah. It's amazing how you're right. It's like every movie is basically the hero's journey, you know?
Yeah.
And every book is basically the hero's journey. And yet we never get tired of it, you know? I guess it's our life story, you know, and we need to be encouraged, you know, or see another example of it. So to kind of say, well, if Rocky can do it, I can do it, you know, something like that.
What about for you? You know, because occasionally I'll see your writing kind of, it slips back into it at time, talking about aspects of it, whether, you know, you're talking about being in the wilderness, or again, like we just talked about the process of individuation. You wrote about that for a couple of weeks.
I feel like everything I write about is the hero's journey. You know, every novel that I write, you know, I basically have a sort of a template in my mind of, like when I have an idea for a story, I'll sort of rough it out in my mind, and then I'll kind of superimpose this kind of template over it to see if they match. And that template is basically the hero's journey. You know, I'll ask myself, you know, does the hero start out in the ordinary world? Is there a scene that's the call to action, or a call to your calling? And then does the hero resist that call? Is there a beat of the refusal of the call? And I'll just go right through all of those beats, make sure that the story hits them at least one way or another. And almost always it will, even though when I'm sort of evolving the story, I'm not thinking about the hero's journey at all. I'm thinking about what would happen, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then when I compare them side by side, I almost always find, oh, yeah, it's pretty close to exactly what it. So, yeah, that's really what I do. That's my occupation.
Yeah. I think, like I said, we, you know, talked about a little bit earlier, your blog post is what ignited, you know, an obsession that I haven't figured out how to escape yet.
Well, just, you know, send me a dollar, Joe. That's the important thing.
Another question I have, and I think, again, this applies to writing, this applies to anything creative endeavor, entrepreneurial startup, or even in the military. And that's facing self-doubt.
Mm.
How do you get through it?
It's a great question. I was talking to a friend of mine about this the other day, and I realized that when I start a new project, like a new book, for the first 9 months, at least, I am racked with self-doubt all the way through. And in fact, I have now like a mantra that I tell myself, which is, if I'm not feeling intense self-doubt, something's wrong. I should be feeling, you know? So I think it's just self-doubt in that case, in my opinion, is pure resistance with a capital R. And what it is it's the devil or whatever who is behind resistance trying to stop us from doing this particular project. And the more important that project is, or the better it is, it's like resistance somehow senses that it's good, or if it's good for us. And the better it is, the more self-doubt it'll throw at us. So I try to turn it around in my mind and I say, if I'm feeling a lot of self-doubt, that's a good thing. That tells me that the dragon that I need to slay is really shooting a lot of flames out of its mouth at me.
Right.
And so it's like the virtue, in my opinion, that I've tried to teach myself. And you hear about this in Robert Greene's stuff and everything, is to just keep going in the face of self-doubt. And particularly the more monumental the self-doubt, the stronger you have to be to kind of keep going through it. So it's not a bad thing, I think. It's a good sign when you feel it. And there's no defeating it. It's like defeating fear. You can't defeat it. The only thing you can do is keep going despite it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times we get this misconception that, well, you know, Steve's written a couple books, or so-and-so has gotten a couple of promotions, or, you know, so-and-so has been wildly successful. They probably don't have any self-doubt. And what I've learned doing this podcast is that everybody suffers from self-doubt. I think the difference is, do you work through it? And the other night, I got to interview Terry Hayes, he's got two novels to his credit, I Am Pilgrim and The Year of the Locust. But he was the screenwriter for all the Mad Max movies, did a bunch of projects with Mel Gibson, George Miller, you know, wrote the movie that was Nicole Kidman's breakout. And then in mid-50s decides he wants to write his first novel. And he told me the first couple hundred pages, he was sailing through it, loving it. And then all of a sudden, self-doubt just smacked him right in the face and it scared the crap out of him. But like you said, he just put his nose down and kept working on it paragraph by paragraph, page by page, and ended up selling millions of copies afterwards. But then he started his next novel and it was the same thing all over again. So much, I mean, it took him 10 years to write his second one. And so I've just learned that it's part of it.
Yeah. Like you say, the podcast is a great thing, Joe, because it lets you inside people's heads, you know, that I'm sure a lot of the people that you interview, before you meet them, you think, oh, this person has really got it together, you know, no problem, they're sailing, you know. And then when you talk to me, you'll find that they go through hell too, you know, and it's kind of encouraging in a way because it tells you, you know, that you're not alone, you know. If you're suffering this stuff, you know, so do a lot of people you admire. They suffer the same stuff.
Yeah, and I appreciate you sharing it as openly as you do. And I know, I think like 6 months ago, I think I reached out to you because I was completely stuck. I didn't think this project was going to work. I was going to be able to move past it. I think you were working on something too, in your same place.
Yeah. Yes, I remember. I was exactly the same place. Yeah. But it's all resistance. It's all our own self-sabotage. And it can be a good thing because that devil knows what's good and just wants to stop it. So the more it's trying to stop it, maybe that has something to do with the dragon's tail looped around St. George's horse's hoof. I'm not sure of how, but
yeah, maybe so.
That's a great little tidbit there. I don't know what it means, but it's great.
I don't either. We'll just make something up for it. I know you've come into contact with a lot of different people from all sorts of backgrounds over the years. I mean, have you found this kind of the same thing? Is it, you know, everybody that seemed like they had their shit together was also, you know, just struggling?
Pretty much. Yeah. You know, when you get to that moment, you know, when it's late at night and you're, you know, you've had a few too many beers or whatever, and people let their hair down. Yeah. Pretty much everybody will tell you a story, you know. In fact, I like to hear that from people, you know, like anytime I meet somebody that's in AA, you know, and that I'm not in AA, but I sort of feel like I should be, not from alcohol, but from resistance itself, you know?
Right.
And I always love to hear the stories of, you know, the darkest moment when, you know, people turned it around, you know, and just sort of found their humility and said, I can't do this by myself. You know, I gotta get some help somewhere.
Yeah. That's another thing I wondered, like, does community help you at all?
Yes.
With what you do? I know, like, writing is a very lonely, It's a very lonely endeavor, but the role of community for you.
Not in the sense of having a writer's group or other writers or artists that I talk to or would show my stuff to. In fact, the opposite. I will not show it to anybody. But, you know, I'm a big believer, as you know, Joe, in the muse.
Right.
And in help that's coming from a higher dimension. And that's kind of the community that I sort of trust, which comes through in my dreams and in like moments. I'm not actually a journaler like you are, but I journal kind of in my head. And, you know, you get a community inside your own head. But just in real life, community is really important.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it always helps. Again, I think I need kind of that reassurance from other people sometimes. And that's what I think, that like, I'm not crazy, you know, that like, this is okay. And I think for me, you know, reaching out to you in that moment, I'm like, hey, I don't know if this is going to work, you know, and just kind of hearing that. I think for me, that's an important part of it. And then, you know, Amanda's constantly reassuring me, which I'm sure for you, Diana does the same thing, and it's very encouraging. But yeah, it's I'm learning a lot, you know, through this process, and you know, even 20 years in the military, that self-doubt, it doesn't go away. It's just, how do you face it? How do you fight through it? Is the key.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about, I'm sure you know this book, Defeat into Victory.
By Slim.
General Slim.
Yeah.
Which is like, every young officer should read that book, you know, cover to cover. And it seemed to me kind of contradictory to what you and I are just saying, that he didn't seem to be racked by self-doubt. Maybe he just left that part out. But, you know, I mean, the one scene I'm sort of thinking about, this is probably boring, you can cut this out of the podcast, but in Burma, in charge of the British Army, and they're getting their asses kicked by the Japanese. World War II, right? I mean, really kicked. Like that one scene where they had to cross the river, the British troops retreating, and most of them were in their underwear and didn't even have weapons. And it was up to General Slim to like turn that around somehow. It's like, how the fuck do you turn that around? And he talks about just finding a little space, and he got out a little pad of paper and he started writing down, you know, first he kind of drew a little map of where the enemy was and where he was and where India was. And then he started kind of making a plan. Well, this is what we have to do. 1, 2, 3, 4. And I remember thinking, that is really incredible. You know, without that guy, what would have happened to all those troops, you know? And that was leadership, you know? And the way he just went into a room by himself with a piece of paper, no assistants, you know, no staff, and made a plan, and it worked. You know, 3 years later, they retook Rangoon and da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
That's an amazing book.
I think what you said about writing down, and I'm not in any way trying to compare a situation I was in to Slim by any means, but I recall being in a tactical situation. It was a training exercise, and everything, like the wheels are just coming off. Like it is... Just imagine like this giant ball of yarn, and the yarn is just starting to like, you know, kind of float away, and like reaching out and grabbing it with my hands and pulling it all back together with all my might. And what I did was I sat down by myself and just wrote down a list of things that needed to happen right away. Mm. So instead of looking at the problem at the hole that the, you know, Japanese are pushing us back, you know, to the tip of the peninsula or whatever. Uh-huh. And for me, instead of looking at the entire thing that I was doing, I just started writing down everything that needed to happen in the next 5 minutes, the next 10 minutes, the next 30 minutes. And it just kind of, I don't know, just writing something down on a list helped me get my wits back under control.
Do you remember, Joe, what the specific points were that you wrote down? What specifically needed to happen?
I do. I'm not going to share it because I think it would actually give it away, but it was, it was everything from who needs to get this order, who can I trust to do this one thing that'll solve this problem? Uh-huh. Where do the vehicles need to go right now? How are we going to get our communication systems up, and who can I get to focus on that? And so,
Oh, that's great, Joe.
But before that, it was just complete chaos, Steve. It was so frustrating, man. Like, I'm like sweating right now.
What I really love about that is the idea of you're asking what has to happen right now.
Yeah.
So true. Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely it. And then going back to what you do, right? You're going to write a 300-page novel about a guy named Telemann and a mute girl. Like, you know, how are you going to get from point A to point B? I would imagine that it's, you know, one word, one line, one paragraph, and you just keep going with that. And, you know, again, it's that idea of, hey, maybe I'm making too much of a leap, but the idea of just writing something down and giving yourself a little bit of order to go from.
Yeah, it really does help, doesn't it? Just putting it on paper.
Yeah. So, man, I got to move this back to you, Steve, because that situation that you brought up, it was super stressful for me.
I bet. My hat's off to you. I would have freaked out, I'm sure.
What are you working on right now? Can you say? Or
I'm working on a follow-up to that Telemann story.
Okay.
The novel A Man at Arms. You know, the further adventures of Telemann.
Awesome. Okay. And then is any other projects, maybe not related to writing, that's kind of in the works? Or
well, you know, Diana and I have kind of started a little publishing company, just the two of us, you know, for just my stuff and her stuff. And so we're heavily involved in that. And we're doing a lot of like writing things down on a page, you know, what has to happen first, you know, open a bank account, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that's been fun. Like, you know, when you got the Daily Press field, it came in a package from Diana, you know, with all kinds of other stuff. And that's kind of stuff we've been working on.
You and Diana outdid yourselves with the Daily Press field package. That thing was amazing. All the, you know, pieces of artwork that were in there, the little journal that you could write as you're going through the book. I loved it.
We stole that idea from Jack Carr.
Okay.
The thriller writer, you know, of The Terminal List and stuff.
Yeah.
A few years ago when we first met him, he sent out a gift box like that, not to promote it, but just to friends. You know, he just sent out a few of them, and they had the book, and then they had a little other, you know, a little notebook, and they had a little challenge coin and some coasters and stuff like that. So when you open this box, which was like a really nice box, there are a bunch of goodies in there. It was like a Christmas present. And so we thought, shit, we got to do this too. This is really a great idea. And so that's how that came about.
Do you still have them for sale?
We still do. Yeah, we still do. Yeah.
Okay. If you're listening,
we had our garage was full of them, you know?
If you're still listening with me and Steve on this conversation, really encourage you to go on their website and grab one of those boxes for yourself. I'm actually looking at mine right now. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. The website is just my name, Stephen Pressfield with a V. It's all there. Yeah.
All right, Steve. I appreciate, again, third interview on the show. I appreciate your time. I love these conversations. I always learn something from you.
I do too. I learn a lot from you, Joe. It's great just to hang out with you. So thank you for having me. It's great to be on three times and hope we'll do it four.
We will. I'm sure we will. Well, you have a great morning there in California, and look forward to chatting again, Steve.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Joe. Love to the family. And till next time.
Till next time.
Thank you again for listening to another episode of From the Green Notebook Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please give us 5 stars wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us gain visibility and the opportunity to help more people on their leadership journey. Also, make sure you check out our website at www.fromthegreennotebook.com. There, you can listen to past episodes, read leadership articles written by military leaders from around the world. You can sign up for our monthly reading list email where you can learn about new books that are coming out, and our Sunday reflection email that comes out every Sunday morning. Is really short. It's a 2-minute read, but I guarantee you it's going to start your week off on the right foot. Finally, make sure you follow us on Twitter at FTGNNotebook, and you can find us on Instagram and Facebook by searching for From the Green Notebook. Again, thank you so much for coming on this journey with us. I am humbled by the opportunity to learn these lessons alongside you. So please join us next week for another episode of From the Green Notebook, where we're going to help you lead with the best version of yourself. I came from the mud. There's dirt on my hands.
won't shoot me down soon.